with the People's Republic of China. So for Taiwan, although we ended diplomatic relations with Taiwan and no longer regarded Taiwan as a government that represented China and that was a sovereign, independent state, we acknowledged, without formally recognizing, but we acknowledged and did not challenge the Chinese position that Taiwan is a part of China. And so we also established relations with Taiwan, but unofficial relations, non-diplomatic relations, which included contacts in the economic, social, cultural level, some degree of governmental level, but not through diplomatic means. And then
we have 10 seconds, Michael.
Then the sale of arms. So we have this kind of a balance now that the United States has tried to keep in its relations with Taiwan, which is now fraying badly.
Well, this is something we will continue to cover. Michael Swain, director of the Quincy Institute's East Asia Program, longtime U.S.-China relations analyst. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Masaya Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker, Shireen Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Kamelman, Carlos Davila. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 7th Annual Vanport Mosaic Festival, on now through Tuesday, June 7th in Portland. The Vanport Mosaic is back with its annual Memory Activism Festival to, quote, remember, repair, reclaim, and reimagine our collective story. The festival will center on the 80th anniversary of the building of Vanport, once Oregon's second largest city and the largest World War II federal housing project in the United States. Highlights include Vanport the Musical and a panel discussion on Portland's past, present, and future of affordable housing. Again, that's the 7th annual Vanport Mosaic Festival, on now through Tuesday, June 7th in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Stand by me. Stand by me.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. A judge determines that People for Portland's ballot measure on redirecting funding for unhoused people is unconstitutional. A new Department of Justice policy requires officers to stop others from using excessive force. And in international news, Russia closes in on key eastern cities in Ukraine as the war reaches its third month. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 24th, 2022. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. A Multnomah County judge ruled Monday that a proposed ballot measure, filed by People for Portland and meant to redirect funding set aside for helping unhoused people retain permanent housing, is unconstitutional and cannot move forward to the November ballot. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
A Multnomah County judge ruled yesterday that an effort to change the way the Portland region addresses houselessness cannot move forward as is. People for Portland is a nonprofit organization whose stated mission is to provide a platform and voice for Portlanders to take grassroots action to advance shared community values. The group has been trying since March to get a houseless measure onto the November ballot. Its proposal shifts most of the monies generated from a tax on affluent residents away from services to keep people in their homes and towards creating temporary shelters. Their proposal also tried to make authorities in the Portland region enforce their public camping bans to receive the funding. Metro lawyers rejected People for Portland's proposal twice, saying the measure violates the Oregon Constitution. People for Portland went to the Multnomah County Circuit Court. The court ruled in Metro's favor yesterday, saying People for Portland made two legal errors. First, the group failed to include the full text of the Metro Code that the ballot measure sought to change, meaning voters would be unable to fully understand what the initiative was trying to do. Second, and more significant, the measure proposed changes that went beyond the regional government's authority. The judge ruled Metro has no power to dictate through code how each county spends tax money for houseless services. The Metro Homeless Service measure passed in 2020. The 1% tax on high-income earners should generate about $250 million annually for supportive housing services intended to help people at risk remain in their housing. That aid includes case management, rent assistance, and shelter. People for Portland's measure wanted each county to spend 3/4 of the money they received through the tax on houseless shelters. The counties would have to continue spending most of the tax money on shelter until each county had enough beds for every person experiencing houselessness in the region. People for Portland said the ruling in Metro's favor represents a, quote, dramatic change in Oregon's initiative system that will limit the ability of the people to have a say in their government. They have only succeeded in silencing voters in defending a homeless crisis status quo that is failing everyone, end quote. The group said it is evaluating next steps. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Congress's infrastructure measure could help modernize a port in Coos Bay. The economic benefits from a prosperous port could help a range of interests in the region, including education. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Funding from the infrastructure measure Congress passed last year could benefit a struggling rural community in Oregon. Lawmakers in the state have requested part of the $1.2 trillion Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act go to modernizing the port at Coos Bay. The region has seen a decline in timber harvest. Supporters say a thriving port could bring jobs back, which also could benefit the local school system. Terry Jones, an elementary school librarian, says kids growing up in Coos Bay typically have to move away after they graduate, but an upgraded port could change that.
Whether they're going to school or another occupation, they're probably going to have to start out somewhere else because there are no jobs here. And this is a really exciting opportunity.
Both Democrats and Republican lawmakers have asked the Biden administration to make funds available for the Coos Bay port. Earlier this month, the administration developed a plan to reduce red tape and accelerate federal permitting and environmental reviews for projects. Valerie Eisline is a special education assistant in Coos Bay. She says the region needs to be cautious with how it handles the port upgrade, so it doesn't disturb the sensitive and unique estuary in the area. The facility is designed to be the first ship-to-rail port facility on the West Coast to cut down on emissions from trucking. Eisline thinks it would be worth it if the economics ultimately benefited local families and their kids.
Funding should always be based around them. They are our next generation, you know, that are going to run our companies and our businesses. Let's educate them and show them that this is their future.
Jones believes kids in Coos Bay would benefit from a productive port for a simple reason.
When we talk about school success, we tend to look at test scores and attendance. And I've always maintained, personally, that irregardless of the programs and curriculum you implement, if you raise the socioeconomic threshold of a community, you will raise test scores.
Supporters of the port also say it would help with supply chain issues on the West Coast. The upgrade could make the facility one of the busiest in the country. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
Health officials in Washington state are investigating a presumptive case of the monkeypox virus in King County. The case is an adult male who recently traveled internationally to a country that reported monkeypox cases recently. Initial testing that confirmed an infection was done Monday. Further testing will be done at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The man is not hospitalized and is recovering at home. According to King County health officials, he does not pose a risk to others at this time. Monkeypox is a virus that originates in wild animals like rodents and primates, and occasionally jumps to people. Most human cases have been in Central and West Africa, where the disease is endemic. Monkeypox belongs to the same virus family as smallpox, but causes milder symptoms. The incubation period is from about 5 days to 3 weeks. Most people recover within about 2 to 4 weeks without needing to be hospitalized. Most patients experience fever, body aches, chills, and fatigue. People with more serious illness may develop a rash and lesions on the face and hands that can spread to other parts of the body. People exposed to the virus are often given one of several smallpox vaccines, which have been shown to be effective against monkeypox. Antiviral drugs are also being developed. This is the first time monkeypox appears to be spreading among people who did not travel to Africa. Confirmed and suspected cases have been ticking up in Europe and North America. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told reporters on Sunday that the U.S. has a vaccine ready to be deployed to treat monkeypox if necessary. A recent survey found Oregonians of Asian descent are going out in public less, out of fear from an uptick in harassment. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
There's been an alarming rise in racist incidents against Asian residents in Oregon, and it's changing how community members behave. The Oregon Values and Beliefs Center finds 61% of respondents identified race-based harassment as a serious community issue. About half had heard a racial slur directed at them or a family member. Amory Vogel with the nonprofit that conducted the survey says one-third have reduced the amount of time they spend in the community as a result of these incidents. She notes if that number is extrapolated for all Asian Americans in the state, it comes out to more than 50,000 people changing their behavior.
That's more people than live in the city of Grants Pass. So if you think of an entire city of people saying they're not going out to spend time with friends and family at the end of a pandemic, which has already isolated people.
The survey was launched at the request of the Asian Health and Service Center in Portland and the Asian and Pacific American Network of Oregon. Vogel says the data is disturbing on many levels, and 87% of respondents say they didn't seek mental health support following these incidents. She says it also could have an impact on communities' small businesses. Some have suffered property damage like graffiti, and already were struggling because of the pandemic. Vogel says adding the fact that some potential customers are afraid could be a recipe for disaster.
I could see it creating a real crisis within these communities. And what happens to these people if they lose access to these businesses, especially within their own neighborhoods? They have to travel farther to get to the services or the products or their jobs even.
Vogel says people aren't likely to report hate incidents, and some aren't sure what is considered a crime or worth reporting.
People think that the only place to report is to the police. And so the Department of Justice is a great resource for determining, is this a crime? Is it a bias incident that we need to just track and help provide services to people? Or do we need to get the police involved and the FBI even?
Oregon Values and Beliefs Center does monthly surveys of Oregonians. Anyone can participate and will be compensated for their responses. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
The U.S. Justice Department is updating its use of force policy for the first time in 18 years, saying explicitly that federal officers must step in if they see other agents using excessive force. The rules apply to all agencies under the Justice Department, including the FBI, DEA, ATF, and U.S. Marshals Service. The policy's first portion deals with deadly force, barring tactics such as firing guns to disable cars. The next sections call for de-escalation training and spell out situations in which officers have an affirmative duty to prevent or stop other officers from using excessive force and to render or call for medical aid when it's needed. The DOJ policy was announced days before the 2-year anniversary of George Floyd's death. Federal officers have not been involved in the vast majority of recent high-profile cases in which people of color have been killed by local or state police. The new policy states that law enforcement officers should be able to recognize and act on, quote, the affirmative duty to intervene to prevent or stop, as appropriate, any officer from engaging in excessive force or any other use of force that violates the Constitution, other federal laws, or department policies on the reasonable use of force, end quote. The policy goes into effect on July 19th. Exactly 3 months since Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine, Vladimir Putin's forces are pushing to encircle two key eastern cities in an assault that could define this phase of the war. Russia pushed ahead with its eastern offensive Tuesday, intensifying an effort to take two cities in the Donbas region. If successful, the operation would cut off Ukrainian troops from the rest of the country. The twin cities sit on either side of the strategic Seversky-Donetsk River. Despite strong Ukrainian resistance, Russia has increased the intensity of its operations in the Donbas. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned of difficult weeks ahead for the region. Some 20 countries have announced new security assistance for Ukraine, including more high-tech weapons that Ukraine has been pleading for. Many countries are donating critically needed artillery ammunition, coastal defense systems, tanks, and other armored vehicles, while other countries have come forward with new commitments for training Ukrainian troops. The United Nations has verified almost 4,000 civilian deaths so far in Ukraine. Officials noted that the actual death toll numbers are likely far higher. You're listening to a spring membership drive special of the KABU Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KABU membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kabu.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with KABU's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. Then at 6, it's Preference. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 59 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 75 degrees. Today in history, in 1884, the Brooklyn Bridge over the East River opens, connecting the cities of New York and Brooklyn for the first time in history. Thousands of residents turned out to witness the dedication ceremony, which was presided over by President Chester Arthur and New York Governor Grover Cleveland. Designed by John Roebling, the Brooklyn Bridge was the largest suspension bridge ever built to that date. The quote of the day is from American Baptist minister and leader of the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr., who said, quote, "I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war that the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word." End quote. President Joe Biden says the U.S. would aid Taiwan if China invades. Ukraine's president addresses the World Economic Forum, and the Supreme Court weakens a path for incarcerated people to challenge their convictions. With more on the story, it's Jonah Chester with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We remain committed to supporting the peace and stability across the Taiwan Straits and ensuring that there's no unilateral change of the status quo.
President Joe Biden says the United States would provide military aid to Taiwan should China invade the island nation. Taiwan declared independence from China after World War II, and officials in Beijing have long wanted to annex the country. U.S. support of Taiwan has been a point of contention with China as the two nations wrangle over trade and human rights issues. Biden's comments came as he met with Asia-Pacific leaders on Monday to reestablish diplomatic relationships, 5 years after former President Donald Trump pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Through a translator, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida told reporters Biden's new Indo-Pacific economic framework has the support of his nation.
Having said so, Japan hopes to see the United States return to the TPP from a strategic perspective.
The New York Times reports a dozen Asian-Pacific nations will join the new economic bloc. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky gave a virtual address to the World Economic Forum in Davos Monday. Speaking via a translator, Zelensky urged the forum to push for more economic sanctions on Russia and criticized world leaders for not taking such actions in 2014, when Russia annexed the once Ukrainian territory of Crimea.
If that happened back then, that unity, that pressure on governments, on companies, would Russia start this full-scale war? Would it bring all these losses upon Ukraine and upon the world? I'm sure that the answer to this question is also no.
The Supreme Court Monday stripped back the ability of incarcerated people to challenge their convictions based on ineffective legal representation. In a 6-3 decision, the justices held federal courts cannot consider new evidence when revisiting criminal convictions handed down by state-level judges. The decision may mean a death sentence for the two Arizona men on death row who brought the initial suit, alleging their post-conviction lawyers were incompetent and did not provide adequate representation during their trials. In a dissenting opinion, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote the decision violated the Sixth Amendment, which guarantees the right to an attorney, and added the ruling, quote, hamstrings the federal court's authority to safeguard that right, unquote. Vice President Kamala Harris visited the Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C. Monday to mark National Mental Health Month. Harris said there is an urgent need to address the mental toll the pandemic has taken on the nation's healthcare workers.
The problem existed. This burnout issue existed even before the pandemic.
Harris's comments came as the U.S. Surgeon General released a new advisory on health worker burnout and resignation. The report projected America will be short more than 3 million essential low-wage healthcare workers in the coming years. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Interior Secretary Deb Haaland recently celebrated the restoration of a bison range with tribes in northwest Montana. And 19 U.S. senators are requesting the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs hold a hearing on legislation to establish a Truth and Healing Commission on Indian boarding schools. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland recently celebrated the restoration of a bison range with tribes in northwest Montana. Montana Public Radio's Freddie Manadas has more.
So please let us a big round of applause for my hero, Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland.
Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes Chairman Tom McDonald introduced Haaland to a crowd of several hundred people inside the Salish Kootenai College's basketball gym on Saturday. Haaland says with the loss of tribal homelands and depletion of bison herds, tribes have lost traditional connections with bison.
But in spite of that tragedy and loss, we are still here. You are still here. And that's something to celebrate.
Haaland says the restoration is a culmination of Native people's resilience, conservation guided by indigenous knowledge, and the Biden administration's commitment to honor treaty obligations. She says it's a return to something pure and sacred. In late 2020, Congress passed and former President Donald Trump signed a bill returning management of the bison range to the tribes. The federal government unlawfully took the land in the 1900s. Chairman McDonald says the bison range is more than a restoration of land for the tribes. It's a restoration of a piece that has been missing and a gift to pass on to future generations.
For us to share this story and begin our healing journey here with the first American woman Secretary of the Interior elicits emotions in all of us that I cannot put into words.
For National Native News, I'm Freddie Monades.
Despite the crisis of missing and murdered indigenous people, only a small number of cases are listed in federal databases. The Mountain West News Bureau's Robin Vincent reports these omissions are getting noticed and drawing frustration.
During a recent committee hearing, Senator Ben Ray Lujan of New Mexico pointed out there are nearly 10,000 cases of missing and murdered indigenous people. Yet the combined number of cases listed by the Department of Justice and Bureau of Indian Affairs is roughly 60.
The goal of all of us is to bring more attention here. Undermining this is going to show that, oh, don't worry, we got it under control. No one needs to do anything. And that's terribly wrong.
A representative with the Bureau of Indian Affairs told the senator one reason for the dearth of info was a personnel change. He said shortly after the launch of their website, an employee responsible for data entry left. Senator Lujan said his office is monitoring the number of cases, or lack thereof, listed in the federal databases. He urged federal officials to prioritize an issue that advocates say is slipping through the cracks. For National Native News, I'm Robin Vincent.
19 U.S. senators are requesting the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs hold a hearing on legislation to establish a Truth and Healing Commission on Indian boarding schools. The commission would investigate, document, and acknowledge injustices of federal government policies, including attempts to terminate Native culture, assimilation, and human rights violations. During a recent House subcommittee hearing on the House version of the bill, tribal leaders and advocates called for its passage. Shawnee Chief Ben Barnes testified.
So this commission's purpose is not to point fingers, lay blame, or evoke guilt in people who are generations removed from these atrocities. It will simply help American Indian communities find information that would otherwise be unattainable and bring an opportunity for some semblance of closure. We cannot go back and change the past, but we can and must hold ourselves accountable for doing the right thing today. The stories of human suffering at these institutions can no longer be hidden from view or ignored. It is time that they take their place in public conscience.
Last week, the senators sent a letter to leaders of the Indian Affairs Committee requesting the hearing. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Since admitting earlier this month to an outbreak of the highly contagious Omicron variant, North Korea has only stated how many people have fevers daily and has identified just a fraction of the cases as COVID-19. It remains difficult to get a true picture of the outbreak in the country, and some experts say North Korea is likely underreporting mortalities to protect Kim Jong-un from political damage. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
After having proclaimed for over 2 years that the country was untouched by the coronavirus, North Korea now faces a potential health catastrophe. Its unvaccinated population is succumbing to an Omicron variant, and the leadership is struggling to contain it. Figures on infections and deaths are very unreliable, but what is clear is that the Kim Jong-un regime is caught between unpalatable choices: either a complete national lockdown and acceptance of foreign help, or tentative measures that run a high risk of failure. The central problem for the North Koreans is that they failed to take preventive steps when they had time to do so. They could have accepted help from China, the UN, and Western sources to begin nationwide vaccinations. They could have begun a nationwide testing program, along with hospital preparedness and stockpiling of equipment. Instead, the regime closed its borders, thinking that being the hermit kingdom would ward off the disease. As a Korea-born Harvard doctor with extensive experience in the North has written for CNN, North Korea's medical establishment was totally unprepared for the Omicron variant. Even now, the regime is still calling COVID a fever, but it needs an estimated 60 million doses for its population of around 25 million. Unfortunately, those doses have been distributed elsewhere, and as Omicron variants crop up again, North Korea's people may have no recourse. Now Kim seems prepared to follow China's example with a strict lockdown to achieve zero COVID, but that idea faces several obstacles. One is that the lockdown won't be strict enough. In order to keep the flagging economy running, factory workers will still need to go to work, though confined in groups within production facilities. That will make social distancing difficult to enforce. Second, North Korea doesn't have China's capacity for ensuring that quarantined people are fed and tested regularly. Informal markets will remain open, as the food system cannot deliver a basic diet for all, another potential source of spreading disease. Moreover, the North Korean authorities are surely aware that zero COVID is failing in China, despite all China's advantages in delivery of food and medical supplies. In Shanghai and a number of other large cities, local Chinese officials are unable to get food to people under lockdown in a timely way. Entire apartment buildings and even neighborhoods have been forced to quarantine when only a single person is infected. These harsh measures have led to protests and some violent incidents. Also relevant is that the pharmaceutical distribution system in North Korea is far from orderly or reliable. Kim Jong-un called the system irresponsible and ordered the Army's Medical Corps to stabilize the supply of medicines in Pyongyang City, according to the North Korean press. That order suggests it will be a long time before people outside the capital have access to COVID-19 remedies, when and if they become available. This potential human disaster has not kept Kim Jong-un from investing in the country's missile and nuclear weapons programs. This year alone, the regime has conducted 16 missile tests so far, including an ICBM. U.S. intelligence is reporting that another ICBM test can be expected shortly. An underground nuclear test may also be in the cards, the first since 2017. Some of these tests may be attributed to the election of a new president in South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, a conservative who promises to take a harder line on North Korea than his predecessor followed. President Biden will shortly visit South Korea for his first meeting with Yoon. The North Koreans have a penchant for conducting missile tests to greet leaders of adversaries. In a rational world, North Korea would be putting its military agenda on hold, reaching out for vaccines, medical equipment, and food, and engaging in a crash program in public health prevention and treatment. Likewise, South Korea, the United States, China, and the UN would take the lead in responding to Kim's plea for help. In fact, South Korea's president has offered unconditional vaccine aid to North Korea, but he hasn't received a response. Human security, not weapons, should be the central issue on the Korean Peninsula, and advancing human security is the surest path to real security. But North Korean leaders, hypersensitive to foreign interference, and no doubt anxious not to expose their prison gulag system to the outside world, may be quite prepared to sacrifice thousands of lives. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to a spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 24th, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Jonah Chester, Antonia Gonzalez, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Stay tuned now for Totality of Circumstances.
This is KBOO Portland.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is Totality of Circumstances, a monthly show about the intersections of police and community in Portland. My name is Sam.
And my name is Jasmine. This month, the midterm election results showed that Commissioner Joanne Hardesty is headed to a runoff with the police union-backed candidate Renee Gonzalez. Hardesty is the most senior commissioner on this Portland City Council, after Mayor Wheeler, of course, and whether or not she's reelected